From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, an 11th-hour deal with Detroit satisfies one of the city's last two creditors.
Now this creditor has come full circle and is saying, we want to be part of Detroit's comeback.
Enterovirus 68, it's making kids dangerously sick around the nation. Has it come to Michigan?
Certainly we're on alert.
The Michigan-made music that crossed the Atlantic to Great Britain, starting with Motown.
There was something joyous, wasn't there, about the sound of Motown. And it was like nothing we'd ever experienced here before. It was a hit factory.
And we figure out why are Canadians so smart about science.
Our science-based museums are often huge institutions with great programs tied into Canadian broadcasting, Canadian television.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. Are Canadians better at keeping up with scientific discoveries? A recent report finds our Canadian neighbors go to the head of the class in terms of science literacy. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, why Canada's scientific culture seems to be stronger and deeper than here in the U.S. But first, two of the loudest voices objecting to Detroit's bankruptcy adjustment plan have been bond insurers Syncora and Financial Guarantee Insurance Corporation, known as FGIC. Both companies left holding the bag in a $1.4 billion pension deal known as the swaps. Well, things just got much colder and bleaker for FGIC. That's because Syncora and the city have struck an 11th-hour deal. Chad Livengood of the Detroit News is with us. Now, Chad, on the very first day of this bankruptcy trial, Judge Rhodes virtually twisted the arm of Syncora's attorney and got him to say Syncora was looking for 75 cents on the dollar, and the city was offering, what, 6 cents?
They were offering 6 cents, according to Syncora's math, 10 by the city, But now they are apparently willing to settle for 26 cents on the dollar through a pretty amazing and complicated little package of cash, bond revenue off of parking revenue, and real estate. In particular, Syncora is a multinational insurance company. They're domiciled in Bermuda, and they happen to own the company that manages the Detroit-Windsor Tunnel. They picked up the American Roads LLC in that company's bankruptcy because that company owed Syncora money as well last year. They ended up just acquiring the firm, and with that, their lease for the American side of the tunnel. And so under this deal that they have struck with the city, they're going to get a 20-year extension of the lease through 2040 of the tunnel from the city of Detroit. They're going to get the parking garage below Grand Circus Park, which is a pretty popular parking garage within shouting distance of Comerica Park. And they're going to get some other opportunities, some real estate in and around the tunnel that would help allow American Roads to redevelop it. And they're going to get a coupon.
Tell us about this coupon.
A $6.25 million coupon that they can use to bid on other real estate, potentially the Ford Auditorium site right near the tunnel, and also even possibly Joe Louis Arena. So it's a really interesting turn of events here. We've gone from this really strident creditor that emergency manager Kevin Orr called the Huns of Wall Street, and essentially they've been the back and forth, just name calling, real nasty. The same creditor just a few weeks ago was accusing a federal judge, Gerald Rosen, of scheming to rig the grand bargain and steal the art from other creditors' hands to benefit solely pensioners. And now this creditor has come full circle and is saying, we want to be part of Detroit's comeback. And essentially, the city's going to put its fiercest rival to work.
That's amazing. I love the quote that I read in the Detroit News with Syncora lawyer Stephen Hackney saying, quote, it feels better to be loving rather than fighting. Well, now what for FGIC, the last holdout?
Yeah, I mean, Fidzik really is the last man standing, because also yesterday, Oakland, Wayne, and Macomb counties came together and agreed to create this regional water authority and put down all of their objections to the city's plans and its plan, and how it was going to manage the Detroit Water and Sewerage Department. So Fidzik is this other multinational insurance company that is on the hook for $1.1 billion of insuring these pension bonds that the city took out to prop up its pension fund during the Kilpatrick administration. And so right now they're getting anywhere between 6 and 10 cents on the dollar based on the city's current offer. So it's going to come down to whether they can find some real estate, too. I mean, the city basically said that they're tapped out when it comes to cash. They're already having to borrow money to sort of facilitate some of these settlements, and there's only so much money to be sort of squeezed out of the city's coffers to begin with. And so this will become kind of a crucial aspect. The other thing about this Syncora thing, there's other parties not besides the city that have to agree to it. And in particular, UBS and Bank of America, they are the companies that were engaged in this interest rate swap that Syncora had insured. And when they got forced to take 29 cents on the dollar from the city and settle to a roughly $290 million claim, they take $85 million. They have held open the possibility that they'll go after Syncora for a $200 million insurance payment, basically.
Okay.
And Syncora wants those banks to agree that they won't have to pay $200 million. So, you know, in reality, Syncora could be getting closer into that 75 cents if they can get off the hook for a huge insurance payment, which, frankly, probably threatened the life of that company.
It does prove there is creative horse trading that can happen really at any point in this process.
Yeah, this story, it just continues to evolve by the hour, and it's been kind of a wild train to keep track of at times.
Chad Livengood, Detroit News, keeping track of the wild train ride for us with the Detroit bankruptcy proceedings. Thanks so much, Chad.
Thanks for having me.
Cases of the severe respiratory illness known as enterovirus 68 have been confirmed in the Midwest, including Missouri and Illinois, although nothing is yet confirmed in Michigan. Dr. Matt Davis is the state's chief medical executive, and he joins us now. So, Doctor, nothing confirmed in Michigan at this point?
That's right, Cindy. We don't have any confirmed cases of enterovirus 68 among folks in our state. However, over the past weekend, we did notice an uptick in the numbers of cases of children between the ages of 5 and 17 showing up at emergency rooms across the state with breathing troubles. Those numbers were several hundred cases per day higher than we typically see at the beginning of September.
To what do you attribute that, Doctor?
It's certainly possible that we may already be seeing enterovirus 68 activity in Michigan, but it's not routine to do swabs that would be testing for the different runny noses or the cough type of secretions that these kids might have. Because it's not routine, it wouldn't necessarily be something that we would detect as enterovirus 68.
Are the alarm bells ringing when you see such an uptick in admissions and being treated for these respiratory problems?
Certainly we're on alert, and what the Michigan Department of Community Health has done this week, given the uptick in cases over the weekend and given the news from Illinois and Missouri, is to say to our hospitals across the state, let's go ahead and be more vigilant about doing these swabs and see whether we can detect the cases here in our state. What that will do is help the healthcare providers across the state know what's going on in our communities and also allow us to track this outbreak in our communities and know when we don't any longer need to be on alert for this problem.
Now, what we've seen in the news stories and the headlines from other states is that these cases are not only they are unusually severe, they can develop and progress very quickly, can't they?
They can present quickly, and what has been the hallmark of this so far when it comes to enterovirus 68 is that the actual symptoms of the cold don't actually look that severe. In fact, less than 1 out of 5 kids has actually even had a fever with these symptoms. So it doesn't look as serious in terms of the viral illness as, for example, flu does. But the problem has been that kids have had a lot more breathing troubles than you'd expect for the relatively mild symptoms of the illness. And that is what has concerned parents and providers alike.
What's your advice to parents listening about either protecting their children and also being alert for when it's time to call the doctor?
Well, there's the prevention type of approach, and also there's the awareness part of the story. So in terms of prevention, what I've been recommending to my patients, because I'm a primary care pediatrician at the University of Michigan and Mott Children's Hospital, is to use the sort of approaches that we use to help keep each other safe during flu season. What that means is being extra aware of how important it is to wash our hands with soap and water regularly or use hand sanitizer, to avoid touching common surfaces like doorknobs that can be an easy way to spread germs, and also to cover our coughs and sneezes to prevent this virus from spreading from person to person. That's on the prevention side. When it comes to being aware of symptoms, certainly colds can be regular colds and not enterovirus 68. So really the key thing to watch out for here is trouble breathing. We know that enterovirus 68 in Illinois and Missouri was particularly hard for kids with a history of asthma, but we also know that in about a third of cases, the parents say that these kids who were affected didn't even have a history of asthma. So anytime a parent sees wheezing or difficulty breathing or extended periods of coughing, that's a time to give your doctor a call and talk about whether your child needs to be evaluated.
Dr. Matt Davis is the state's chief medical executive. Thank you so much for talking with us, Dr. Davis.
Thanks for having me.
Welcome back to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Well, it's no secret that Michigan has turned out some mighty powerful figures in the world of pop music. Musicians and artists whose influence rocketed out of Michigan and spread around the world. A great example of this is the United Kingdom. So many artists there were influenced by the R&B and Motown music, the Beatles, the Stones, the Who, and so many more. Chris Hawkins is a music journalist, and he's a host on BBC Radio 6 Music, and he joins us now from Manchester. Hello, Chris.
Hi, Cindy.
It's good to have you with us. You know, Chris, I think about the beginnings of this kind of love affair that British kids had with American R&B and Motown music. And, you know, we take for granted internet streaming. Click on, you know, your smartphone or your iPad or your laptop, and you can hear music from all over the world. But when these British kids were first getting wind of R&B and Motown, that certainly wasn't the case. How'd they discover it?
Well, it was all about vinyl, of course, in those days. And in the clubs, it relied upon DJs travelling from the States to the UK and UK DJs travelling to the States, hearing the sounds and physically bringing them back. As you say, it's all about streaming these days. And I think it's staggering. I was doing some research talking to some teenagers in the UK recently, and they had no concept of owning a record collection, which is a completely alien idea to me. And I guess it is to you, too.
Yes.
The idea of not having a physical collection. They think it's ludicrous. Why would you buy your music when you can get it all for free? At least you can listen to every single song you want. And in their minds, and they're probably right, there is not going to be a time when they can't get music for free.
Isn't that something?
Isn't that weird? Well, because I love opening up the sleeve of a CD these days. And in the past, I loved flicking through my vinyl.
Yeah, well, and the other thing it did is it let you explore things that you didn't even know were there. You would open up a record,
right,
and there would be all the sides on each side of the album, all the songs on each side of the album. So it wasn't just, well, I like this one and this one and this one, and picking the track that you want to add to your collection of MP3s.
Totally, and very often spending your pocket money on records because you like the sleeve. You go to a record store on a Saturday, check through what you were really interested in, and then you might look over, you might have gone for one particular record, but really liked the cover of another and bought it on that basis alone.
Well, I know when, Chris, when Sir Paul McCartney came to Detroit, came here to Michigan in 2011, he played a huge concert at our baseball stadium at Comerica Park. And before the show, he made a specific request and a point of touring Hitsville, USA, which is that little house that was home to Motown. And while he was on the tour, he's found a battered old Steinway piano. It was right there in Studio A. And he asked to play it. And they said, oh, it's just in such terrible shape, it can't be played. And Sir Paul went, really? And then he paid to have that piano shipped to New York to Steinway, paid to have it rebuilt, and then he played it at a benefit concert for the Motown Museum, all because he loved Motown music so much. And
wow.
Does that kind of thing surprise you?
Well, perhaps to a point, it's an extreme thing to do, and you have to have a lot of money to be able to do it. But I think that's a great thing, isn't it? That's paying back the dues that the Beatles perhaps owed to, if not Motown, but to the music of an amazing city in an amazing state.
What other artists do you think were heavily influenced by the music that came out of, we'll say out of Detroit, because we were talking about these early days, and I think Motown was the big, big thing out of Detroit.
Yeah, of course. So let's pick an example. Let's say Tears of a Clown, Smokey Robinson. Okay. Quintessential, for me at least, and I think for perhaps anyone in the UK, you may beg to differ, but I think you'll probably agree. Quintessential Motown artist, right?
Yes, very much so.
Perfect Motown soul act. He was on the Ready, Steady, Go Motown special, which pretty much broke all Motown acts here in the UK. And with that music by Stevie Wonder, the lyrics by Smokey, that song has everything.
I was also told when I interviewed Martha Reeves, she was very clear that she and the Vandellas had a huge following in England when Dancing in the Streets first broke in the 60s. But even when I sat down and talked with her 10 years or so ago, she was still drawing big crowds whenever she'd come over and play in England. Her
yeah,
loyal
I went
English
to see
fans.
Her. Yeah, I saw her not too many years ago, but in the last 10 years. And you know what? That felt like being a part of something very special. It was one of those nights where you just thought, there are not going to be too many more chances to experience this. And she was still brilliant now.
Well,
and you think about not just what she has achieved and what the music that she and they made, but what a bigger picture she was a part of, and that factory, that unrelenting music machine that was Motown.
Yeah. I was also told a story by a kid from Manchester who made it big, and that was Peter Noone, who was Hermit of Hermit's Hermits. And
yeah.
When the Hermits were huge at the really peak of their career, and they packed Olympia Stadium in Detroit with screaming girls, of which I was one. After the concert, Peter Noone told me he went to Hitsville. He didn't have an appointment. They didn't let him in. They were recording at whatever time. And he said he just sat on the porch just to soak it up.
Yeah.
And again, it struck me of how much passion artists from England had for this music. What was it, do you think, about this Motown sound that just made them go, wow? What was it replacing and what spoke to them?
That's a very good question, because we were, of course, coming out of a period of 50s rock and roll, and through the 60s, the Beatles, as you were talking about, the Beatles breaking through. And then there was something new. Can you describe it from your side? Because I think you probably have a different perspective. I'd be interested to hear what you think it was from, as an American, what you think it was that made it so appealing.
It was the production. I think it was that incredible wall of sound that the Funk Brothers offered up every time that they played on track. So it was just that like Dancing in the Streets, for instance. It was just, it captured the moment in America, and it spoke to everybody in many ways, whether it was let's have a great time, or there were others who saw Dancing in the Street as a call to civil rights, action. So it just was some kind of a wonderfully universal sound that just kind of shook it up. The way that when the Beatles came here, that shook everything up. So instead of crooners like Bobby Vinton or Bobby Rydell or, that kind of softer sound, bam, here comes this new sound.
And there was something joyous, wasn't there, about the sound of Motown? Something joyous, but as you say, the lyrics often a little more complicated, a little more deep, a lot more to the writing in some cases too. And it was like nothing we'd ever experienced here before. It was a hit factory, and it was a reliable source of music too, because it was hit after hit, and it made artists huge stars, and we adopted those stars in many ways here too. Going back to Tears of a Clown, I think I'm right in saying this, you may know otherwise, but I think it was a B-side, certainly when it was released here in the UK, and it was actually an English woman who was head of the Motown fan club in the UK who insisted that it would be a great single and was wasted as a B-side, and that's how it got known.
And there you go, somebody just acted. And in fact, speaking of an individual person with a lot of influence, we ought to talk a little about in those early days as these bands were coming out of England and trying to break into America, it was Detroit radio, or really Windsor, CKLW in Windsor, and a woman named Rosalie Trombley, who was their program director, who heard My Generation and Can't Explain and these early songs and said, I'm playing them on my station. And it was a huge station. And I think there are a lot of UK artists who credit that woman and that radio station for getting them off the ground in America.
That's an amazing thing, isn't it? Having that kind of history and to think that there is one person perhaps that could be deemed responsible for changing the face and the sound of music.
Yeah, yeah. Pete Townsend of The Who is always very open in praising Detroit for launching The Who, and you will find it isn't hard to find Detroiters who saw the Rolling Stones and saw The Who playing at Southfield High School when they were just starting to make it in America, and then later the Grandy Ballroom, which was a legendary rock club in Detroit. Then moving through these decades, from the Motown glory days, Chris, what do you see as some other artists or songs from Michigan that really, really had big impact in the UK?
Well, I'd like to come back to the blues, but let's talk about perhaps punk and The Stooges, No Fun. What a song. What an amazing piece of music. It's a game changer, isn't it? An incredible piece of music. And I think I'm right in saying that this is what came before the Ramones. This was long before the Sex Pistols too. Yes. This was it. This was the beginning, not just a change in music, but the change to a culture, a cultural phenomenon.
You're right, it was a sea shift, and Iggy's still chugging away.
Well, the wonderful thing that you have given us, and I mean very specifically at BBC Radio 6 Music, is Iggy Pop, because he's a colleague of mine at 6 Music and presents a show every Sunday afternoon.
And he's from right here in the Ann Arbor area, so we'll...
Absolutely. Have you seen him play?
I have not myself. I know people, there are people who have huge influence, and I hear it's an incredible experience.
Yeah, I think we've got Iggy to thank for stage diving. I think if anyone can ever be responsible for being the first person to stage dive, it may have been Iggy.
Now, another artist from Michigan, started in Bay City and then grew up in Rochester Hills, Madonna Louise Ciccone. And what an impact she's had.
Well, in terms of Michigan music sparking a response in the UK, I don't know that any artist has been more popular than Madonna. There have been those that may have matched her, but in terms of her music and popular culture, she has icon status. Vogue, it was, that took moves from the underground gay clubs into the horrid, as I remember, little night spots that I used to go to in the small town where I grew up. Everyone was voguing, and I remember nights at this particular club, I'll name it Park Lane, in a small town called Shrewsbury, where the DJ would put on Vogue, and I can remember vividly standing at the bar watching inebriated friends and locals attempting to Vogue, and those sights will live in my nightmares forever, Cindy.
I'm speaking with Chris Hawkins, who's a music journalist, and he's a host on BBC Radio 6 Music, as we explore the impact of Michigan artists on UK fans and UK artists. Now, I'm interested in Eminem. He just actually recently sold out Comerica Park for two solid nights, he and Rihanna playing together. How much impact and influence is Eminem having on in the UK?
Do you know, I remember playing My Name Is on the radio for the very first time. I was doing a Saturday afternoon show on the BBC's radio station for London. And I remember the producer, I remember this so clearly, the producer of the programme came to me. The show started at 2 in the afternoon. And at 1:45 that afternoon, he'd been dropped off a single by the record company and told it would be good to get this on the air as soon as possible because this guy's going to be big news. And I can remember the sleeve, it was red and white, and it said My Name Is on it. So we listened to it very quickly. We put it on and thought, okay, right, this is going to be massive. Is it really going to be massive? It didn't really feel like it was going to be a big record. But we played it on the show. The reaction was mixed, as you can probably imagine. But of course, he went on to be huge. And I remember seeing him at Milton Keynes Bowl the last time he played in the UK. And I remember Cypress Hill was supporting. I remember him not only being of superstar status at the time,
yeah,
he had an aura about him and he had attitude. And I remember, if this is any gauge of how popular and how sold out that gig was, it took me 3.5 hours to get out of the car park afterwards.
Oh, that is a gauge. Oh, boy. How about Kid Rock? Now, I can tell you, the reason I'm asking this is because We wind up, my family and I wind up going to Ireland often because we have relatives there. And I can remember being out in the tiniest corner in County Galway where it's Irish speaking and English is understood. And I walked in and what's playing is Kid Rock all summer long. And they were so impressed that I was from near where Kid Rock lives. So does he have a following in the UK?
Do you know what? I'm going to say, yes, he probably does, but he's not on my radar and he's not on any of my friends. I'm mid to late 30s. And I think that's Kid Rock is a successful artist on MOR radio. Okay.
Yeah.
So he's a big playlist artist. And that particular song, this time of year, of course, it's huge. But beyond that, I'm not sure that Kid Rock is a massive deal in the UK.
Yeah.
And as I say, certainly not for me and not for Six Music.
We have such a techno music scene that's coming out of Detroit and out of Southeast Michigan. And I have talked to these DJs who know that they have really, really avid UK fans. What kind of impact is Detroit's techno making?
Well, I think it all stems back. I'm going to take this right back to Strings of Life, Derek May, under the name Rhythm is Rhythm, okay? Mm-hmm. And you'll remember when this came out. He was a guy who was at school with a couple of friends who became the Belleville Three. And that track, it got its name from Frankie Knuckles, okay? And it basically sparks what we know as acid house, okay? This is where it all started with that particular track. And that was a scene that, for me personally, it was just when I was starting to go out and I was aware of pub culture and club culture. And with that track came a different clubbing scene completely. A London club called Shoom opened in around about 1986, 87. And it was DJ Danny Rampling's club, and he and his wife opened it. And it was a very different feel. It was a hazy fog. It was a kind of dreamy atmosphere, and the acid house music played. And that time here in the UK became to some the second summer of love and the smiley T-shirts. And then with that, in terms of culture, there was then this huge fear after the tabloid newspapers here supported this whole idea of the summer of love. Then came the recreational drug culture with it, and the tabloids turned completely on this kind of sound and blamed these DJs, these clubs, for the use of drugs in the UK in a big way for a fairly long period of time in the end.
Interesting. And I know they, again, thanks to the internet, so much can be explored and shared from country to country and across an ocean with a click. I would be interested, as someone who is a music journalist, who follows music, who plays music to audiences in England, Chris, would you be able to characterize or describe a Michigan sound?
Do you know what? I can, in a contemporary way.
Go.
The White Stripes.
Good point.
Yeah, okay, so there is Motown, of course, and we will have that forever. It's a musical treasure, the whole Motown sound. But you know what? I think the White Stripes do it, and I think they are incredible. They're one of my favourite bands of all time. I've seen them play live on a number of occasions. I think Jack White is as close to genius as it's possible to be. The guy is incredible, and with that garage blues sound, he does what maybe John Lee Hooker started in the 40s and has encapsulated a part of every scene since, and is a groundbreaking artist, and he knows how to make a great record. And I'm not talking about your Kid Rock mainstream sound.
Right.
I am talking about alternative music made in a way that it's impossible not to appreciate its brilliance.
Give me three adjectives that you would use to describe the White Stripes sound.
Innovative. Mm-hmm. Interesting. The next one has a hyphen. Mind-blowing.
There you go. You get it. Very fun to talk about music with you, Chris Hawkins, who's host on BBC Radio 6 Music, as we explore the influence that musicians and artists from Michigan have had in the UK. Chris, thanks for talking with us on Stateside. It's been a blast.
Thank you, Cindy. Great to talk to you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. There have been many voices speaking up in favor of a second bridge between Detroit and Windsor. Top Canadian officials, Governor Rick Snyder, big business, all hungry for this planned new bridge. Interestingly enough, one of those speaking up for a new bridge is someone who stands to lose his livelihood once this bridge is built. Greg Ward operates the Detroit-Windsor Truck Ferry. It carries trucks hauling hazardous materials across the Detroit River. That's because the Ambassador Bridge is not certified for trucks carrying the likes of gasoline or paint. Greg Ward is here with us now. Greg, you were one of the first to lead the call for a second bridge. Why, when it could put you out of business?
It's the larger picture that needs to be looked at. Instead of just looking at our parochial interest of a ferry operator, the border does need redundancy and resiliency to support our current economy and any future growth. And therefore, it was very evident to me that you need to do more than what we have today, the antiquated structures of the bridge and the tunnel and a very small truck ferry.
And you've been working in the shadow of the Ambassador Bridge for how many years now, Greg?
We're in our 24th year. We started on Earth Day 1990.
And I guess you were touching on this. What does the very existence of your ferry business say to you as a concerned citizen about the Detroit River crossing infrastructure that we have today?
Well, if something happened at the Ambassador Bridge, be it maintenance, be it an act of terrorism, be it weather, who knows what, the only alternative for trucks crossing the border is our ferry service, which takes 8 trucks per crossing. And if you look at 10,000 trucks crossing a day, it's not sufficient to support what the market needs. And that's a very dangerous situation for our economy, for all the manufacturing, for all the nurses and medical personnel that goes across the border. We need a lot of redundancy and resiliency in our transportation system.
And it's not there right now, in your view?
No, it's not. We have a bridge that was built in 1929, a tunnel that was built in 1930, and a small ferry that carries just a niche group of trucks. We carry the hazmat, and we also carry the very large trucks, the windmill towers and the press crowns and heavy construction equipment.
So that's quite a stark picture that you draw. And my understanding, tell me if I'm right, that you and your father were actually pressured by Ambassador Bridge owner Matty Maroon to sell your business to him?
He has been, he has expressed interest through his various people through the years. We have been in a conflict with the bridge company. The regulations are very clear that they should not be transporting hazardous materials. That's not always the case. There's been many instances where they do take hazardous materials, which then increases the risk of the already critical infrastructure. They recently tried to change the regulations to allow themselves to transport those goods, and that was rejected at the state level and the federal level.
So you kind of have a track record between that and the fact that you're right out there in front of this push for the second government-owned bridge that you're pitted pretty squarely against Matty Maroon.
You know, I really try not to think of it that way. I really try to look at what is best for the region. And you shouldn't do a construction project for jobs. That's not why you do a major infrastructure project. But one of the benefits of this project is there will be thousands and thousands of jobs, and that's thousands and thousands of families that will benefit. We have to really look at this as a very large regional project, not just affecting Detroit, but it affects Michigan, Ohio, Indiana. It's a very large regional project that will expand our opportunities. And that's what we need to reach for and not just look at ourselves. If you look back in 1929, they built a bridge and a tunnel at the same time. We're having indigestion about building one bridge 80 years later.
Well, speaking of families, what about yours? What have you and your family business once this second bridge is up and running? What would you do?
We'll look for opportunities that exist at that time. It's really, you know, hard to plan your life on with so many unknowns. We just try to do our best every day. We try to support what's right, which we believe is the new crossing, and we just go on.
Greg, do you see this entire saga, as you called it, indigestion, well put, is this a test of democracy, do you think?
I think in some ways it's been a perversion of democracy because one individual has had more than his share of input into the system, you know, and that, I think, is really perverts the system. It should be the one vote, one person, but because of the arrogance and the well-funded pocketbook of Mr. Maroon, he uses it to try to influence politics and try to influence policymakers in a way that's advantageous just to his company. And I understand that motivation, but our system, our political system, should be based on what's best for the nation as a whole. And it's very evident from a security perspective, from an economic security perspective, that having the redundancy in the system is important, is critical. And therefore, I think it is a test of democracy.
Greg Ward owns the Detroit Windsor Truck Ferry. Greg, thanks so much for talking with us on Stateside.
You're welcome. Thank you for the opportunity.
Canadians have a pretty good grasp of science. That's according to a recent report from the Council of Canadian Academies. The panel commissioned a nationwide survey of just how Canadians relate to science. And compared to similar surveys in other countries, Canada ranked first in science literacy. 42% of Canadians are able to read and understand newspaper stories detailing scientific findings. We share a border, so why are Canadians so far ahead of the U.S. in understanding and appreciating science topics? John Miller is director of the International Center for the Advancement of Scientific Literacy at the University of Michigan. He was on the panel that produced this report. Welcome.
My pleasure to be here.
Well, give us a sense of the ways that your survey found that Canada kind of goes to the head of the class in terms of public knowledge and engagement in science.
Well, on the public knowledge side, the United States has had a very good position relative to other countries. We've been second only to Sweden until we did the Canadian survey. But the Canadians have a very strong interest in science. I think they've had a strong public encouragement of science. They have had, for many years, a very limited set of radio and television stations compared to the U.S., and they've had some really world-class science shows to get people interested in that. They also, in their big cities, have really excellent science museums, and so they've had a variety of things to sort of keep science in the public eye in some ways. I think the other thing that makes a difference is just culturally, Canada has not had a component of their population that are basically anti-science. We have about a third of our adult population that are conservative and fundamentalist who have a resistance to science. They reject many things scientific, starting with evolution and the Big Bang and many things thereafter, so that we have this division in our country. It's not a 50-50 division. I mean, it's probably only about a third of American adults are fundamentalists and conservatives and have some reservations about science.
But it's kind of baked into
It makes sometimes institutions a little more reluctant to do things because you're sensitive to the fact that, well, there's going to be these people who object to it. So even school boards sometimes tread lightly. They have to, by law, teach evolution as part of biology. The Supreme Court has said again and again, you cannot teach creationism as a part of science because it's a religious question, not a science question. But Canada's had none of that. They have been much more universal in their acceptance of science. They've had very few reservations about it. They have very small percentage of people who would be classified as a fundamentalist or conservative in that sense. So I think that there is a culture. In fact, the report is actually called Canada's Science Culture because what they're interested in is not just classroom instruction, but they're interested in the sort of the cultural setting, newspapers, magazines, television, radio, museums, all those kind of things.
And what does that accepting culture translate to in terms of the realities of life in Canada? For instance, does it translate to more research? Does it translate to more science-related jobs?
Well, it does relate to a government that has, by and large, been more supportive of scientific research than many other governments. I mean, there's no government on the planet that puts nearly as much money into scientific research as the United States. We do more biological research in the United States than the entire planet put together. So we have always invested very heavily. The Canadians simply don't have the resources to do that level of investment. But among other industrialized countries, they're very competitive with European countries in regard to the amount of money that they put into scientific research. The other interesting thing that I did not know until I was on this panel was that roughly half of their scientists in Canada today were born outside of Canada, which is very interesting. They have had a very long-standing policy of being open to immigration and particularly to people who are coming from countries where there are, you know, wars or oppression or other things. And they have been particularly smart about reaching out to scientists and engineers and people who come like that. So they have a very vigorous scientific community that's not just native-born and native-raised and native-educated, mm-hmm. But they've really taken advantage of sort of the educational resources of the world because they have roughly half of their scientists who are immigrants, essentially.
And how would that
compare? They're permanent residents now, of course.
Right, right.
But they came to Canada as immigrants.
And how does that compare to the percentage here in the States, would you say?
Oh, I think the United States is under 20%. It's low. I'd have to look up precisely,
yeah.
But it's not. The percentage of our current graduate population who are foreign students isn't half, but it's closer. It's getting closer to those numbers. But many of those students, in fact, do not stay here. They come here, they're educated, and they go home again, or they go to some other country. Canada has tended to draw people in, oftentimes after they've been educated somewhere. So that they're not bringing them to Canada necessarily to be educated. They're taking advantage of people who are educated,
mm-hmm.
who for various reasons do not want to be in the country where they happen to be at that time. And so they've been very receptive to that. So I think, you know, in terms of the advantage of a country to be open to immigration, they're a good example. One of the benefits of that is they have a much more vigorous, diverse, anyway, scientific community than many other countries have.
Well, back to what you found about the public and,
yes.
and their understanding, their engagement, their willingness to read a scientific story in the paper and kind of grasp it. And so we're not talking about
yeah.
students. We're talking about people after their education
right.
ended. How would having that here in Michigan, for instance, how might that change the climate for scientists?
It generally, what it would do is it would encourage more students probably to think of science as a kind of a career that would be beneficial to them that wouldn't be contentious in some fashion. It would mean that more of their parents and family would be very supportive of that choice and not worrisome about it in some fashion. I think it means that industries and other people would be more interested in doing research and in sharing what they do with the public in various ways. There's a lot of festivals and outreach activities that go on in Canada through the science institutions. There are scientific or science-based museums are often huge institutions with great programs tied into Canadian broadcasting, Canadian television, into all of the different kinds of media and things that they have. And in the summers particularly and other times, they have some very interesting festivals where people come together and have celebrations and displays and things like that. I think it just leads to a more appreciative atmosphere. People then can say, this is really something that's important. And I think now, especially in the last decade or two, the Canadians have been well ahead of the United States in understanding the threat of climate change. And they see this as a real threat because, I mean, obviously they have, in some ways, they will actually benefit from climate change because a lot more of their land will turn out to be arable than ever before,
mm-hmm.
and a lot less will be frozen. But I think that they also value the frozen northern aspects of their society and the culture. And they also recognize for the good of the planet that all that ice that sits on the north end of Canada is probably a good thing for the planet. And so they're very worried about these changes. And they can see changes in wildlife. They can see changes in their indigenous communities. So I think they have been sensitive to that. And they also understand that some of the solutions could be scientific. That is, that at least we know how to measure things better scientifically than we did before.
And it can translate into personal action where people
yes.
might be more willing because they're accepting of it to change
yes.
their behaviors.
That's right. Yes. I think it makes them a more green consumer-oriented thing. You see many more advertisements in the Canadian media for environmentally friendly this and environmentally friendly that and so forth. So I think it makes a different culture in that regard. And I think just in general, it makes for a certain amount of public support and not in a going out and rallying kind of way, but just an acceptance and support that's sort of always there. It's not questionable as much. So that when something like, say, stem cell research comes along, the Canadians embraced that very early. They've invested in it not nearly as much as they would have if they had the U.S. resources. But they have invested in it. They've been very receptive to it. And they say, well, let's see what it does. You know, let's figure this out. You know, maybe it will be useful. They don't see this as so much of a moral or ethical question.
Interesting finding. Were you surprised by this finding, John?
A little bit. You know, I've been in Canada a lot. And in fact, I've been interviewed a lot on Quirks and Quarks, which, you know, is their big science radio show, which they do over the years. And they've had very excellent people in that whole broadcast journalism. So I know they've had a really strong public interest in science. Well, we would do papers and studies in the United States. You know, you've got a certain number of domestic radio and television stations and people who cover you. But on the other hand, we got a lot of Canadian coverage over the years just because we were sort of their neighbors. And they, oh, yes, well, there's an interesting story in the U.S. on science, and so they would cover that. So I have done a lot of conversations with the Canadians on both television. They have a science discussion programs, almost like, not quite like Meet the Press, but they have these panel discussions of science on various topics and to bring people together. And so,
don't see that a lot here in the States on this side
that.
Of the border.
Nope.
John Miller, director of the International Center for the Advancement of Scientific Literacy at the University of Michigan, helping us answer the question, is Canada a nation of science geeks? Thank you so much for talking with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Has the Batmobile come out to play in Michigan? MLive is reporting on the very first apparent spotting of the Batmobile in Michigan, with images sent in early this morning by someone who claims to work near River Rouge. And filming of Batman v Superman Dawn of Justice is indeed happening this week in River Rouge. The blockbuster film stars Ben Affleck as Batman and Henry Cavill as Superman. It's been filming at the Michigan Motion Picture Studio in Pontiac and around a number of locations in Metro Detroit and elsewhere in Michigan. Well, check it out for yourself. We have a link to the photos on our Facebook page. That's Stateside with Cynthia Canty. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Stateside was directed today by Ali Billings and engineered by Bob Scon. Contributors are Emily Fox, Mike Blank, Michelle Hahn, Haley Hirschman, and Annie Norris. Support for arts and culture coverage on Stateside comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs and the National Endowment for the Arts. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.